Accession number 15577,
Reel 3.
Just lost it with you talking about the treatment you got from that professor.
Well, he put my arm in plaster. They gave me blood transfusion under pressure because I'd lost so much blood that all the arteries in my arms and legs had collapsed, and therefore I was very lucky to avoid gangrene. Anyway, they managed to sort me out in hospital. I was there for some time, and then I was, because it was a civilian hospital, I was moved up to Botley's Park in Woking, which was a military hospital. I was put in a ward there. They then discovered I was a sergeant pilot, and it was an officer's ward, so they were all a bit upset about that and told me to keep quiet. And I was there for some little while because I was on the dangerously ill list when I was taken off the day I was moved. I was taken on a wire stretcher from Chichester to Woking, and by the time I got to Woking I was in such a bad way I was back on the dangerously ill list. I was there, I suppose, for just a couple of weeks or so, and then I was sent to Birkenhead, where they had a rehabilitation centre. That was an interesting journey because I was put on the train at Woking and I was in plaster from my foot to the waist, and my right arm was at a right angle bend, stuck up in the air, so it was all a bit difficult to do anything. Anyway, I got to Woking all right. Got to, from Woking to London all right. I was taken to Paddington, and there were huge crowds around, so I reported to the station commander, and they locked a carriage for me so that I could get on a seat and have some degree of comfort because of the state I was in. That was fine. I was put in there, and hundreds of people kept going to and fro, and eventually somebody came along and unlocked the carriage door. So in everybody got, they filled one side up and I was stretched out on the other side, and in came another gang of people and just pushed my legs onto the floor, plaster and all, and sat down. So I was left sort of lying across the half across the floor, and I had to get a guard call to clear him out. This is the way things worked at that time. Anyway, that's by the way, I got up to Birkenhead and I was there for quite a while, gradually rehabilitating. They got the plaster off my arm and got that moving again. Then eventually got the plaster off my leg, and I was able to get around on crutches, and I went home from there, and then managed to get back on my squadron, and I was on crutches, but I was able to fly again. The squadron then had changed numbers from 181 to 182, if I remember correctly.
182 to 181, I think.
Sorry, back to front, yes. And I had a few, not very many flights from there, and I got the airplane hit again, and I'd got a rather nasty open wound in my arm which was roughly bandaged, and I flew out with that, and I was hit again. The airplane was hit again, not me. And half the tail knocked off, and I got back, and they decided I ought to be moved off to a a sort of rest camp, if I remember correctly. It was going to be a training establishment. And I went up to Bentley Priory, which was the fighter headquarters. Everybody there seemed to have scrambled eggs. They were all air commodores and above. And I felt terrible the first day there. I drove round to the doctors, tried to find somewhere to park, and there seemed to be a nice little place there, which I put my car in and went into the doctors. And I was found to have tram lines all over my chest, which was lymphangitis created by poison, which was this open wound getting oil and mucking it in the aeroplane. And I was whipped into hospital, and I was in hospital for a couple of weeks. Came back, went down to find my car, and the distributor cap was missing. I'd parked it in an air commodore's parking place, so I wasn't very popular. However, I explained the situation and I got away with it. I was then sent, I think, if memory serves me right, to Bristol. Yes, Lulsgate Bottom, where I was taught to be an instructor.
Just going back, how had you been wounded the second time on typhoons?
No, it was only once on typhoons. That was this major thing. The first time I was wounded was in Australia. Singapore.
Yes, but the second time was at Evetoe Junction.
That's right.
But then the third time...
No, I wasn't. I was only... These were wounds that hadn't properly healed. I wasn't
from the second wound.
From the second one, you see, because, you know, it was pretty bad, and there were still some not quite correct things, and I was strapped up.
So it sounds as though you really shouldn't have rejoined the squadron.
I shouldn't have done, but, you know, we all tried to, if you could, get back to it.
Had you done many operations when you returned?
Well, as a wounded pilot?
Yes.
Oh, yes, I did about half a dozen, but I seemed to be out of luck at the time because the aircraft was hit at least three times. So I was bringing back a lot of damaged aeroplanes, and they don't like too much of that. They decided anyway that they thought I'd had enough for the moment. And I was sent up to this FIS to become a training instructor. And the chap who was my teacher there was a fellow who'd been on the original course with me in when I first learned to fly in Tiger Moths. He spent the whole of the war in Canada, got hundreds of hours of flying, and he and I didn't get on very well, because when you fly, and I suppose, fair enough, when you learn to fly, you have to fly, and when you turn, you mustn't have any skid, you mustn't have any slide, everything's got to be perfect. If you want to survive in air combat, you make quite sure that you can't do this, because that's how you survive. Every perfect turn, you're a perfect shot for a deflection shot. But if you skid or slide, you're not. And I taught myself to skid and slide, and it's very difficult to get out of it. Anyway, I passed the course. Didn't like it. I was sent then up to a hurricane training unit, and that was all right. The only thing is that all the trainees had more flying hours than I had, because my flying hours were restricted mostly to operational flying, which are sort of 15, 20, 30, 35 minute flips, and theirs were all the training periods in Canada and so on. I had a spell there, I suppose, for about a fortnight, and I was moved off then to Swinderby, which is a big bomber station, where they wanted somebody to make mock attacks on Wellingtons, no, Lancasters, and that sort of thing, so the gunners could get practice. And I would attack with camera guns, and they would defend with camera guns, and you'd see what the result was. And they wanted somebody with a bit of experience to do this. And I did that for a little while, and I found that as a lot of it was done at very high altitude, I started getting problems with my arms and legs, where all this damage had been done by the shell. And I was sent down to East Grinstead to get some plastic surgery done. This is Sir Archibald Mackinder. And he did a lot of plastic surgery work on my leg. And they then decided that I'd had enough of the war and chucked me out as a disabled person.
What did you think of the work Mackinder was doing in 1944?
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. The whole of that place... I mean, all right, I went down for plastic surgery on my legs, but most of the people there had been badly burnt. And the psychological effect of losing your appearance is dreadful. And it was a hospital which was run on totally different lines to all the hospitals I'd been in previously. Mackinder got chorus girls down from London to wander around the wards and cheer the boys up. The nurses were all taught to be friendly first, nurses second, but they're all top flight nurses. Everything was set up to encourage the fact that you were still capable of being ordinary people. We were allowed beer and spirits in the ward. You could drink if you wanted to. He persuaded the town to accept us, and we went. People went down the town looking in the most dreadful state, and altogether he built up a camaraderie and a tremendous encouragement for people to lead a normal life. The result is we formed a club, and that club is still running 54 years after it was formed.
This is the guinea pig club.
This is the guinea pig club, and we are still in touch with each other and still keep going.
You went back to that squadron, the Typhoon Squadron, in February 1944. I'm trying to think of when you must have been hit at Yvetot Junction.
43.
Was it before or after Christmas, do you think?
Oh, it was oh, it was in early late 43. It must have been about no, I honestly can't remember. I would have said September 43, because it was about 6 months. I was back on the squadron in February 44, so it would have been August, September 43.
Can I just ask you one question about the war, not connected with the RAF, but a general question about that's arisen about the question of national unity in the war? What's your opinion about that?
Well, you look at a lot of kids who look hopeless, a lot of people who look as though they wouldn't do anything for anybody. And you get a war and everybody suddenly pulls together. A war is a very much a get-together syndrome. Nationalism is a very, very strong force altogether. This is one of the problems today with the common market. Your average Englishman doesn't want to become a subject of Brussels. This is national pride. Now, war underlines that to a major degree, as I see it anyway. You get everybody pulling together, reticence disappears. You find people will talk to each other on trains where they won't normally talk. You'll find people will turn around to help each other where they would normally walk by. All sorts of things will go on in a war that won't go on in peacetime.
The reason I raise it is because we saw a television program on recently in which some researcher was presenting the thesis that there was just as much class division in the war as pre-war.
Class division? Well, you'll always get a certain amount of that. You can't help that. I mean, you get class through so-called breeding and you get class through money. There are two different types of classes. You get snobs and you get inverted snobs. I don't know. I think I've always got on with everybody because I never inquire as to where anybody's come from or what they do. I felt in the Air Force that mostly people were perfectly content to get on with each other without any problems. Yes, you've got the different ranks, but again, I was in the fighter side, which is much smaller, and you mixed in much more with your maintenance staff. You'd take them out for a booze party. On a bomber station, being so big, you had to have more discipline, you had to have a greater split between ranks. You see, to have discipline, you can't have officers and men just treating each other as equals. You have got to have a separation. But equally, on a small unit, that separation, that barrier can be broken at regular intervals. Sorry about the clock again.
But did you ever come across strikes in the war, or people who said, well, the rich are getting away with it in a way in which the poor can't?
I never met it. But then my war wasn't in any way where I'd be likely to meet that.
It's the 50th anniversary of that general election in 1945 when Labour got all those seats.
Yes.
Do you think that the vote of the forces had much of an effect in that election?
Oh, I should think so, yes. Yes, there comes a time when everyone wants a change. I think, I don't know, I'm not a political animal to that degree. Churchill had effectively been the main power to win the war, and I think people felt he wasn't the power to win the peace, so they wanted a change, and they had a change. I think the forces were probably a lot to do with it.
Did you feel like that yourself?
No. No. I'm not a political animal, but at that time, my grandfather was a member of parliament, my uncle was a member of parliament, so I tended automatically to support them.
But did you come across colleagues who, in the forces, in the RAF, who talked politically about the need for change?
No, I'm not a political animal. Politics were not a subject I pursue in the forces. Politics and religion were kept out of it.